Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Brian Lynn tells us about the preparations involved in U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to Ukraine. Later, Dan Novak presents this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
U.S. President Joe Biden's surprise visit to Ukraine on Monday took weeks of preparation and careful planning. U.S. officials say Biden took unusual steps, such as not flying aboard his official Air Force One plane, to arrive safely for a one-day visit to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. It was the first time in modern history that an American leader had traveled to an active conflict area without receiving protection from the U.S. military, the Associated Press reported. White House officials admitted that such a trip carried possible risks, even though Russia was informed ahead of time about Biden's visit. Biden left the White House around 3:30 a.m. Sunday. He flew to Europe aboard an Air Force C-32, a plane commonly used for transporting military passengers. During a refueling stop in Germany, the president stayed aboard the plane as it prepared for a one-hour flight to Czechów, Poland. From there, Biden got on a train for a 10-hour overnight trip to Kyiv, the AP reported. The trip was not announced to the Ukrainian public. When Biden arrived, he made several stops around the capital, Kyiv. He was transported in a white-colored vehicle instead of his usual armored presidential car. For months, Biden had considered joining the list of other Western officials who have visited Kyiv to show support for the country as it battles Russian forces. Russia invaded Ukraine about 1 year ago. Biden had already planned to visit Warsaw, Poland. Officials decided the President's Day holiday would be a good chance for him to stop over in Kyiv, the AP reported. Top officials at the White House and U.S. national security agencies began working in secret for months to make the trip happen, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Monday. Biden gave final approval to the plan last Friday. Sullivan said the trip required assistance from many agencies to deal with security, operations, and transportation. That goal, Sullivan said, was to attempt to turn an inherently risky trip into something manageable. Biden met with Bridget Brink, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He then entered his car for the drive to the city's Mariinsky Palace, the official home of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden also met with and visited parts of Kyiv with Zelensky. Even while he was on the ground in Ukraine, flights transporting military equipment and other goods continued to Poland from Western cities. Across Kyiv, many main streets and central areas were blocked off without explanation. people started sharing videos of long lines of official vehicles traveling quickly through city streets. Biden traveled with a far smaller group of advisors than usual. They included Sullivan, Deputy Chief of Staff Jen O'Malley Dillon, and the Director of Oval Office Operations, Annie Tomasini. They were joined by his Secret Service protectors, a small medical team, and an official White House photographer. Also traveling with Biden was a military aide who carries the so-called nuclear football. The nuclear football is a name used for a special bag that contains needed information for the president to order the use of nuclear weapons in case of a national emergency. Only two reporters traveled in the group instead of the usual 13. A small number of Ukraine-based media representatives were called to a downtown hotel and informed of Biden's arrival. It was rare for a U.S. leader to travel to a combat area where the U.S. or its allies do not have control over the airspace. The U.S. military does not have a presence in Ukraine other than a small amount of Marines guarding the American embassy in Kyiv. I'm Brian Lynn.
Many educators fear students will use the artificial intelligence, or AI tool, ChatGPT, to write their reports or cheat on homework. But other teachers are including it in the classroom. Donnie Piercy is a teacher in Lexington, Kentucky. He told his 23 fifth grade students to try and outsmart the tool that was creating writing assignments. Piercy says his job is to prepare students for a world where knowledge of AI will be required. He describes ChatGPT as just the newest technology in his 17 years of teaching that caused concern about the possibility of cheating. They include tools to help with math and spelling, as well as Google, Wikipedia, and YouTube. As educators, we haven't figured out the best way to use artificial intelligence yet, he added, but it's coming whether we want it to or not. One lesson in his class was a writing game between students and the machine. Piercy asked students to find the bot. Each student wrote a short report about boxer Muhammad Ali. Then they tried to figure out which was written by ChatGPT. Teaching a lower grade level, Piercy is less worried about cheating than high school teachers. His school system has blocked students from ChatGPT, but permits teachers to use it. Many educators around the country say schools need time to figure out the chatbot. But they also say a ban will be useless against students that are good at technology and can work around it. ChatGPT quickly became popular after its November launch. Other companies like Google have since released their versions of AI-powered chatbots. At the Future of Education Technology Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana last month, Texas math teacher Heather Brantley gave a talk on the magic of writing with AI for all subjects. I'm using ChatGPT to enhance all my lessons, she told the Associated Press. the tool is blocked for students, but opens to teachers at her school. She said she asked the chatbot to create real-world examples for her math class. For a lesson about slope, or direction of a line in algebra, the chatbot suggested students build ramps out of cardboard. The students could then measure the slope. For teaching about surface area, the chatbot said students would see how the idea works in real life when wrapping gifts or building a cardboard box, said Brantley. Students in Piercy's class said working with a chatbot makes learning fun. After playing Find the Bot, Piercy asked his class what skills it helped them learn, how to properly summarize and correctly capitalize words and use commas, said one student. Another student felt that sentences written by students have a little more feeling, more flavor. Students Olivia Laxey and Catherine McCormick, both 10, said they can see the good and bad parts of working with chatbots. They can help students who have trouble putting their thoughts into writing. And there is no limit to the creativity it can add to classwork. McCormick said students can use it for suggestions, but should not use it to do all the work. You shouldn't take advantage of it, McCormick said. You're not learning anything if you type in what you want, and then it gives you the answer. I'm Dan Novak.
You just heard Dan Novak present this week's Education Report. Dan joins me now to talk about the story. Hi, Dan. There was one word in there that I was hoping you could explain. Enhance.
Sure, Ashley. Enhance means to improve the quality of something. Often, when something is enhanced, the quality was already good, but now it's even better. For example, new eyeglasses enhance your vision, or maybe a car brand has enhanced features.
So, how is the word used in the story?
Texas math teacher Heather Brantley said chatbots like ChatGPT enhance her lessons by helping her come up with real-world examples for math ideas. So, while many educators have been worried about how students might use chatbots, some teachers are using it to their advantage.
Seems like these teachers think chatbots are not something to be feared.
Yeah, I think you're right. One interesting thing a teacher in the story said, David Piercy, is that chatbots are just the latest technology that teachers feared would bring about cheating. He said educators were just as worried about things like Google or Wikipedia. He said there isn't much we can do to stop these technologies. They are coming out whether we like it or not. And if they can teach students how to properly use them, they may be less likely to use them for cheating.
I liked how one of the students in the story said that students' writing had more flavor compared to chatbot.
Yeah, I like that observation as well. If you spend enough time with chatbots, you will notice that they can get a bit repetitive in their responses. However, it's important to remember how early in the development of AI chatbots we are. They are only going to get more creative and smarter as time goes on. But I don't know if a chatbot could ever truly replace the writing of a human.
Well, thanks for joining me today, Dan, and thank you for that interesting report.
Anytime, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. During the second half of the 19th century, the United States was not concerned much with events in other countries. It was too busy dealing with events inside its own borders. At that time, the nation was recovering from the Civil War. It was expanding to the West, and it was developing industries. As production increased, the United States began trading more and more with other countries. At the same time, it needed a new foreign policy to defend its interests. Morris Joyce and Larry West discuss America's foreign policy in the late 1800s.
A growing number of lawmakers called for a new foreign policy. One was Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. Lodge said, "The great nations of the world were taking control of the world's undeveloped areas." As one of the great nations, Lodge said, "The United States must not fall out of this line of march." Another lawmaker said, "Fate has written our policy. The trade of the world must and shall be ours." Some of these ideas came from the writings of Captain Alfred Mahan. He was head of America's Naval War College. Mahan wrote that all the great nations in history had possessed great sea power. He said the United States must build up its sea power, too, if it wanted to be a great nation. Sea power, Mahan said, was more than a strong navy. It was an economy that could produce goods for export. It was trade ships that could carry the goods. It was colonies that could supply raw materials and markets. And it was overseas naval bases that could defend American interests far from home.
The Washington Post newspaper described America's growing power this way: "A new understanding seems to have come upon us, an understanding of our strength, and with it, a new feeling. We want to show our strength. We are face to face with a strange fate. The taste of empire is in the mouth of the people." The Washington Post was not speaking for everyone, of course. In fact, many American presidents of the late 1800s did not have this taste for empire. Yet, they were forced to face the future. Changes were coming, and it was their responsibility to guide the nation through the changes. For this reason, the United States entered into several agreements with foreign lands during the late 1800s.
In 1878, for example, the United States signed a treaty with Samoa. The United States agreed to help the South Pacific Islands settle any differences with other nations. A few years later, the treaty was put to a test. A group of Germans living in Samoa forced the island's ruler from power. They replaced him with a ruler who was more friendly to Germany. For a time, it seemed the United States and Germany would go to war. But when American warships arrived in Samoa, so did a big storm. The storm smashed both American and German ships. Neither side was left with a force strong enough to fight. In 1889, the United States, Germany, and Britain agreed that Samoa should be an independent kingdom. For 10 years, local leaders attempted to establish a strong government. Their efforts failed. In 1899, Germany took control of Samoa's large western islands. The United States took control of the smaller islands to the east.
Events in another group of Pacific Ocean islands affected American foreign policy in the late 1800s. These were the Hawaiian Islands. Hawaii was an important port for American trade ships sailing between the United States and China. Good relations between Hawaii and the United States were necessary to keep the port open to American ships. In 1891, Liliuokalani became Queen of Hawaii. She was not friendly to the United States. A group of American businessmen and planters in Hawaii plotted to oust her. The group started an uprising. Then it called on the United States for protection. Queen Liliuokalani was forced to surrender. The businessmen and planters formed a new government. They wanted Hawaii to be part of the United States. By the end of the century, Congress had made Hawaii an American territory.
The United States also offered to serve as a negotiator in several international disputes during the late 1800s. One dispute involved Britain and Venezuela. Both countries claimed land that bordered the British colony of Guyana on the northeast coast of South America. The situation became tense when gold was discovered in the disputed area. The United States offered to negotiate an agreement. Britain refused the offer. The United States offered again. Britain refused again. Finally, President Grover Cleveland asked the United States Congress to appoint a committee to decide the border. Before the American committee had a chance to meet, Britain and Venezuela agreed to let an international committee decide.
In 1895, Cuban rebels revolted against the colonial government. They tried to destroy the economy of the island by burning private property. Spain sent a large force to Cuba to crush the revolt. Thousands of persons were arrested and put into prison camps. Many died of hunger and disease. Spain was denounced for its cruelty.
It was difficult to get a true picture of what was happening in Cuba. American newspapers sent reporters to the island. But much of what they wrote about never happened. The reporters knew very well that exciting and horrifying stories sold newspapers. So they made up stories about bloody battles and Spanish cruelty. One incident has become famous in American newspaper history. Publisher William Randolph Hearst sent artist Frederick Remington to Cuba to paint pictures of the fighting. Remington spent several months in Havana. He saw no fighting. He sent Hearst a message. Things were quiet, Remington said. There would be no war. Hearst sent back this answer. You supply the pictures. I'll supply the war.
The newspaper built up strong public feeling against Spain. Soon, many Americans were calling for war to free Cuba from Spanish rule. William McKinley was president. He did not want the United States to become involved. He did, however, offer to help Spain find a solution that would return peace to the island. Spain refused the offer. It attempted to improve the situation in Cuba by itself. Spain called home the military commander accused of cruelty. It stopped putting people in prison camps. It offered equal political rights to all Cubans, and it promised them self-rule in the future.
President McKinley welcomed Spain's policy statements. He felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises to the Cuban people. He said the United States would not interfere. At about that time, however, riots broke out in Havana. President McKinley said it was his responsibility to protect the lives and property of Americans living there. So he sent the battleship Maine to Havana. During the early weeks of 1898, President McKinley waited for Spain to act on its promises to Cuba. He saw little progress. Relations between the United States and Spain became tense. Then, on the night of February 15th, a powerful explosion shook the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor. The ship sank. More than 250 American sailors were dead.
No one knew what caused the explosion on the battleship Maine. The United States said it was an underwater bomb. Spain said it was something on the ship itself. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks. Yet, some people in the United States blamed Spain anyway. They demanded war. They cried, "Remember the Maine!"
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.